I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're going to focus on air power during the First World War. We're looking at David Stevenson's With Our Backs to the Wall, Victory and Defeat in 1918, one of the best books in the last sort of decade or so written on the First World War. It's particularly good because the first part of the book really focuses on the dramatic events up until November 1918, and the rest of the book looks at kind of thematically at how the war was won by the Allied powers. And here he focuses on air power and its development throughout the First World War from a kind of a fringe element of the arsenals of combatant powers to really being quite integral by the end of the war, including the air raids on London in the latter stages of the war. So David Stevenson writes, "Integral to the balance of intelligence advantage was air superiority, which had never been more fiercely contested than in 1918. During the war, aircraft speeds and ceilings had doubled, engine horsepower quadrupled, and bomb payloads grew even more. German aeroplane speeds had risen from 80 to 200 kilometres per hour, and maximum loads from 3.5 to 1,000 kilos. During the development of fighters, or pursuit aircraft, as the Allies called them, Hunter aircraft, or Jagdflugzeuge, it was the German term, combat had spread into the skies. Aircraft took up roles that they would keep throughout the Second World War and beyond, not just guiding artillery, but also striking ground targets as a form of flying artillery themselves. They operated at sea and in every theatre on land. They also embarked upon strategic bombing." So, by 1916, the war had reached almost complete deadlock. There was an inability to make breakthroughs. Germany failed to make a breakthrough at Verdun. The Allied powers failed to make a breakthrough at the Battle of the Somme, even though the Somme was part of a kind of a campaign of what was called kind of concentric battles that year, including, of course, the Carpathian Offensive. It still failed to deliver that knockout blow. The reason for this was that basically the Central Powers and the Allied Powers are pretty evenly matched in terms of manpower, in terms of ability, in terms of fighting morale. And therefore, it would have to be technology that would have to be the device for breaking through. The development of tanks, the development of new artillery techniques, and also the use of aircraft were the product of this deadlock. War is unfortunately one of the great engines of innovation, and particularly the First World War. So by 1918, strategic bombing existed as a kind of an idea with both the Germans and the British, And it was discussed by the British Air staff and the Air Ministry. If you kind of go back a couple of months in this podcast, I talked about the development of bombing after the war as a kind of an air doctrine by the RAF and the Air Ministry as a device for holding together the empire. And it was also air doctrines by 1939 were unclear, and at the start of the war it was thought that these kinds of ideas about bombing, which had worked well in the Middle East and Africa to punish insolent tribes, as the likes of Churchill saw it, that was a much more difficult thing to apply to Germany, and the air doctrine throughout the war, bombing doctrine, developed. So in 1918, the British saw for the first time in air doctrine that strategic bombing could mean attacks on the home front and targeting cities, factories, railways, and the infrastructure of war, rather than the enemy on the front line. The efforts of both sides tended to cancel one another out, and so the idea of attacking the home front was ever more enticing. There had been bomber raids on Paris and London, and these had hardened public opinion against Germany and prompted reprisal raids, which perhaps if the war had continued would have become far, far greater. Perhaps had we seen the war roll over into 1919, 1920, then it would have increasingly become an air-led war against various home fronts. The dynamic, the escalation dynamic, which is, you know, the kind of the arms race concept, was in evidence during the latter stages of the war, and it kind of anticipated, it predicted air war later on. But if we rewind a little bit and look at the kind of the politics of aerial combat, in 1899, the first Hague Peace Conference had basically outlawed the dropping of projectiles from balloons. But this had only been for a five-year period, and in 1914, the popular press and fiction writers, the likes of John Buchan and Erskine Childers, had seen, basically, and this sort of also is kind of the root of a lot of modern science fiction from the period, had seen air attacks on Britain's cities. They had predicted these. London's vulnerability caused a kind of a panic in 1913, which led to the kind of spy hysteria and all sorts of things. When the war began, there was little by way of consideration for kind of humanitarian considerations. The French bombed Ludwigshafen in 1914, and then the British continued to raid the border towns of Germany from 1915 to 1916, though neither had actually developed specialised bomber aircraft, so the damage was pretty insignificant. Germany only used Zeppelin airships initially, which could reach London, and they came under the auspices of the German Navy. Wilhelm II, who thought that it was quite fine to bomb civilians, but targeting historic buildings and also the palaces of his cousin King George was a bit too far, believed that perhaps the neutral public opinion towards bombing was slightly alarming. It gave a kind of a clue, really, that this might prove to yield very little for Germany, and might result in retaliation, which would then have an effect on public morale. For a couple of months after the commencements of Zeppelin raids on the 31st of May 1915, the British didn't quite know what to do. During 1916, they developed the new BE-2C aircraft, which climbed higher, was able to be stable at night, and fired incendiary rounds, Buckingham bullets. These were supported by anti-aircraft guns and searchlights, and an improved ground observer system, and shot down Zeppelins at such a rate that by September 1916 the raids had ceased. And again, this sort of infrastructure developing of observer posts, communications, information passed to airfields was the kind of the skeleton of the Dowding system that would later emerge and really save Great Britain in 1940. And the raw material shortages in Germany meant that the airships gradually had to change. The skin was no longer rubberized, and the ribs consisted of wood rather than aluminium. And this started to make them ever more flammable. The danger, which seemed to be over in early 1917, was replaced eventually by four-engine bombers. So the British began to wind down their anti-aircraft civil defence systems, but they would be put to the test once more. The Zeppelin raids were the beginnings of Germany's bombing over London. German engineers designed the Gotha G4 bomber. This had been kind of on the drawing board since before the start of the war, and the German High Command wanted it ready in order to coincide with unrestricted submarine warfare against Great Britain. Obviously, by 1915, when unrestricted submarine warfare began the first time, they weren't ready. But by 1917, when it resumed, they were. The London was 175 miles from the Gotha bomber base in Belgium. They had a 500-mile range, so that gave them sufficient airtime over the capital before returning home. Unlike the French cities, London had a key weakness. It could be approached over water where there's no anti-aircraft fire. And also, as they did in the Second World War, German bombers followed the line of the Thames, which brought them straight through the city. The Gothas initially carried a smaller payload than the Zeppelins, but they were faster. They flew at 87 miles an hour, and they were higher. They could reach 10,500 feet. They were more heavily armed. They carried three machine guns, and they were harder to shoot down. Where the British decrypted the Zeppelin wireless code and always had forewarning of them coming, the first daylight raids of the Gotha bombers were completely unanticipated. They killed 290 people at Folkestone on the 25th of May, and on the 13th of June they killed and injured 594 people when they bombed they bombed London. And hit London's Liverpool Street station in the East End, and they killed 18 children at an Upper North Street school in the East India Dock Road. On the 7th of July, another raid on London killed 250 more people. The media uproar was immense. There was outcry, the argument that the Germans were terrible savages and kind of leading some sort of war against civilization itself was all over the front pages. The War Cabinet returned two fighter squadrons from the Western Front. This was over kind of Haig's insistence that this should not happen. A new agency called the London Air Defence Area was created under Major Edward B.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
The Ashmore, who was an artillery gunner who'd moved back from Flanders. Ashmore also added fighters to the east of London, a barrier, fighters to intercept, and altered the tactics of those fighters so that they attacked the Gothas in large groups rather than singly. And the same weather that was causing British troops havoc in Belgium, rain, fog and low cloud, actually helped the British air defences. In the three raids during August, the Gothas actually failed to reach London. And in the last raid, they lost three aircraft, one to anti-aircraft fire and two to fighters. So they began to switch to night attacks instead. Initially, it wasn't believed; they wasn't certain that night attacks would work, but they experimented with them. Night bomber attacks were the biggest challenge that London faced, and the Gothas were joined by the Riesenflugzeuge, or the Giants, which had a 138-foot wingspan, which was to compare the same wingspan as a B-29 Superfortress. They had a maximum height of 19,000 feet. They had 9 crew wearing heated flying suits, 6 machine guns, and a payload of up to 2 tonnes, including a 1,000-kilogram bomb, which could wreck a housing block. They could take enormous punishment, and none were ever shot down. So during the Blitz of the Harvest Moon between the 24th of September and the 1st of October 1917, the Night Flyers visited London 6 times. The British saw this as a kind of a crisis point. I know that there is a book out there called The First Blitz, and the argument in that book is that this actually brought the British through to breaking point. There was a fear that London could be destroyed. And perhaps if Germany had the resources at the time to rapidly expand its bomber fleet, that might have been possible. The anti-aircraft batteries were nearing exhaustion due to ammunition expenditure and due to the deterioration of the barrels. When guns are fired, they heat up, they cool down, the barrels aren't always the same afterwards. 100,000 to 300,000 people took shelter in the underground each evening, again an echo of the later Blitz. And though contemporary estimates actually say it was much higher than that. Deteriorating weather, wear and tear on the bombers and their crews provided relief. So the campaigns were initially successful, but perhaps not quite as sustainable as they needed to be in the long run. The aircraft obviously have wear and tear issues, even if they're not being hit, and crews become exhausted. So they needed to have a break. And during the winter, better searchlights were installed by Ashmore. Barrage balloons were established, and the Sopwith Camel was shown to be a very effective night fighter aircraft. So, David Stevenson writes, As with the campaign against the U-boats, there was no one spectacular turning point, but gradually the defenders inflicted greater losses and the attackers caused less damage. From October, the British read German wireless messages, and once given more warning, their aircraft destroyed an average of 1/10 of the Gothas each raid. Terrible episodes still took place, such as the bombing of a basement shelter in Longacre on the 28th of January, with over 100 killed and wounded. But in the biggest raid of all, on the 19th of May 1918, 43 aircraft took off, but 6 were lost in action and 7 in accidents, while according to a survey by the medical journal The Lancet, the civilian mood had now improved. From this point, raids on London, though not the provinces, had ended, in part to redirect the bombers to the Western Front. In addition, the campaign was taking a growing toll of aircraft, in total 24 being lost in action and another 37 in accidents. Partly because of raw material shortages, the Gothas were shoddily made and their undercarriage was liable to collapse on landing. By 1918, moreover, British fighters could be mobilised faster and Ashmore established an operations control room where observers' reports were centralised and instructions coordinated in a manner prefiguring the second and more celebrated Battle of Britain. So that's a really important point, that this, in some ways, was the kind of the first or the kind of the lesser Battle of Britain. And this also tells us an interesting story about the development of military technology, about how when it came to establishing an infrastructure for air defence in the late 1930s, that many of the lessons had already been learned, that Ashmore's efforts in establishing things like an ops room where information could be rapidly shared and aircraft, scarce and valuable aircraft, could be rapidly deployed to the places that it was most essential, then that could happen in real time, because of course in aerial warfare, speed is the essence. There was a second Gotha campaign over Paris, which began in early 1918, in the 30th to the 31st of July 1918, and leaflets were dropped over the trenches justifying this on the grounds that the French had refused peace. So it came with a kind of like a parallel propaganda initiative to really encourage French soldiers to give up, to mutiny, to demand peace in the interests of preserving their loved ones at home. By the 15th of September, 14 raids on Paris had occurred and 664 bombs had been dropped. The heaviest of those attacks happened in the spring of 1918 on the 11th of March, when 70 people were killed at the Bolivar metro station in a kind of a panic stampede. So bombers could always rely on fear on the ground achieving the outcomes that they were trying to achieve with explosive bombs. In both the case of London and Paris, one of the main objectives was to break civilian morale. During the Ludendorff offensive in March 1918, on the 22nd, during Operation Michael, which was one of the various stages of the Ludendorff spring offensive, the first artillery shells landed on Paris. One of 370 that were fired between the 23rd of March and the 8th of August 1918. And it was the use of the Paris gun, one of these vast German artillery pieces, that actually did more in terms of kind of alarm to Parisians than the Gotha raids, beg your pardon. 30 tons of bombs were dropped on Paris during the period, compared with 100 tons of bombs on Britain. And in the air defence of Paris, fighters had a much smaller air defence role. This was partly due to the shortage of planes, but it's also to do with the fact that French anti-aircraft gunnery was really quite accurate and effective widespread around the capital. Because, of course, France was only 2 hours flying time from enemy trenches, they had always banked upon the possibility of France being a victim of air raid, and therefore the French were more prepared. The British perhaps less so, and slightly more complacent as a result of the English Channel. Only 11 out of 30 Gothas that departed on January the 30th arrived. And of the 483 sent, a total of 13 were shot down throughout the entire period, and only 37 got through to the city. So the weather conditions, fuel shortages, breakdowns, and all these sorts of things meant that Paris, over the period, had far fewer problems with bombing than the British did. The total casualties, for example, from air raids were 266 killed in Paris and 603 wounded, while the British casualties were 865 dead and 1,965 wounded, and £1.5 million of property destroyed. The comparison that Ashmore made later was that there were 700 lives lost annually on the roads in the 1920s. So it showed you a kind of a steep spike in civilian deaths. These is obviously kind of fairly insignificant stuff when you compare it to the vast losses on both sides in the Western Front. But in terms of affecting civilian morale and bringing in democratic societies civilians closer to wanting to sue for peace, it was considered a worthy gamble by Germany. And the thing that the Germans found, as Hitler did during the war, was that it did not break civilian morale. In fact, paradoxically, it strengthens it. Okay, so we're going to finish there. Thanks very much for listening. I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do, if you can, swing by our Patreon page. There's going to be some new content going on there soon for patrons. And thanks very much for those who do sponsor the podcast. It's greatly appreciated, and it's how we manage to keep going. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.